What's going on, guys? It's JP from the Double Double, and I'm here with my co-host Ben.
What's going on, everybody? Welcome.
And today we just have a bunch of stuff to talk about. The trade deadline is coming up. We'll touch on that briefly, but we just have some bigger picture topics that we'd like to hop into today. The first one being the Los Angeles Clippers. They are destroying the NBA right now. They keep winning over and over and over again. They sit third in the Western Conference, only a game behind the first seed in the West, which is unbelievable. And I just kind of wanted to talk about like how serious are they as title contenders right now? Because I think there's a community of the NBA, specter that is waiting for a knee to blow up or a James Harden shit his pants game, and maybe they're still not getting the respect they deserve as a contender. I just wanted to get your opinion on what their contendership looks like.
I love where the Clippers are at right now as a team. Honestly, it's hard to say that they're not one of the favorites in the West. I am always going to rock with Denver. I think the years and years of chemistry that they have really helps. But I mean, besides James Harden, there's years and years of chemistry on this Clippers team. So I think these are the two teams. You look at Minnesota, and I think the gaps that they have offensively, if Anthony Edwards is not winning you the game, it's really difficult for the Timberwolves to put together wins. The Clippers, the offense that they have, the defense that they've been able to play, Kawhi Leonard, I'm not the first person to say this, but with the addition of James Harden, it feels like Kawhi Leonard's got more energy to put onto the defensive end. We're seeing incredible shit from him. Paul George and James Harden are both having excellent seasons right now. Why not? Why can't they be a title contender?
Yeah, I'm totally with you. You used a phrase a few podcasts ago that I have stolen multiple times since then, where they've found the unselfish way to play selfish basketball. And it's the most true thing I've ever heard about this team. It's such a good way to describe them because the ball is moving, but all three of their star players are so good in isolation that it's kind of this democratic system to get players into the best situations they can to score, no matter what it looks like, whether it is isolation or keeping the ball fizzing around. It's been so fun to watch. This team has climbed my league pass rankings by a million. I was a huge hater of the Harden trade when it happened. You can go back and listen to it. I'm like furious. I'm so angry it happened, and I said they were gonna flame out in the play-in. That is not what it's looking like right now. And in terms of in contendership, I think it's probably going to be a head-to-head matchup between the Clippers and Nuggets, like you said, because of some of the weaknesses I see with the Thunder and with Minnesota. So I think people start to need to start taking this team a little bit more seriously when it comes to hoisting the Larry O'Brien.
I think everybody who's a Clippers fan should be doing victory laps. I think they should be rubbing every sound bite that people put out against James Harden and against the Clippers into the faces of the people who said those things. The Clippers, they're just such a dominant force right now, man. And you watch their offense. It's selfless, my turn, your turn basketball. Sometimes Kawhi Leonard will be posted up in the corner and do nothing for the possession while James Harden cooks and feeds it into Paul George. Like, there's so much offense that comes from so many different places. Norm Powell off the bench is shooting 45% from three halfway through the season. Like, just the amount of offense and the places that it all comes from, it's so much fun. I don't know that there's a more entertaining team to watch in basketball right now than the Clippers. Really.
Seriously, you're right. And I have to shout out Westbrook as well, which is just
Absolutely.
not something I thought I'd be doing at any point of my life. But he's playing with energy, sprinting around screens, and coming off the bench, I think has actually helped him preserve his career a little bit just in terms of like energy and athleticism. He still has that like electric burst that made him so special to begin with.
He's only
And
playing
then
23 minutes a game.
Right, and in those 23 minutes, he's doing the gritty stuff, right? The hard stuff, the fighting for offensive rebounds, the sprinting around screens, poking balls loose. Like, he's an effort guy. He's kind of like supercharged Bruce Brown in a weird way.
He is.
And it's working. And this is like a really cool way to watch an all-time great kind of accept a new role and excel at it. Looking back at his career, you wouldn't think he would have the mindset to do something like this, but he's conquered it and done a great job with it. And I also think it's time we just talk about Kawhi Leonard. I know I'm so biased on this, and I apologize if that shines through here, but I was speaking to Ben pre-podcast. I really do think he's the third best player in the league right now. I really do. And I hope people start to see that as well. Over the last 30 games, he's been averaging 26 points on 57% from the floor, 51% from three, and 92% from the free throw line, with some of the best defense we've seen since Toronto or even San Antonio. So, like, I don't know how many guys can match that production that what he's doing right now.
Honestly, it's fair to say that he's the third best player in the league right now. Steph Curry has fallen off a little bit. It's really, and you know, Joel Embiid is out for the season. So it's Jokic and it's Giannis doing the things that they're doing. And then after that, there, you know, you want to make the case for SGA. He's doing his thing, averaging 32 points a game over the last 30 games. But Kawhi Leonard, just the efficiency is stupid. Yeah. The efficiency is never before seen. The way that he's able to just hit basically every shot he takes from the perimeter. Did you say 50-something percent from the three-point line?
Yeah.
It's absurd. There isn't anybody doing that. It's really like every single spot Kawhi gets to, the efficiency on those spots is insane. He's shooting 81% from around the basket, 53% from 10 to 16 feet on pretty high volume. There's just not a spot on the floor that Kawhi Leonard is less efficient than anybody else in the game.
And we talk about playoff risers as well, right? In terms of, you know, the players that you trust heading into a postseason series, I think those are the three guys as well, right? You got Jokic, Giannis, and Kawhi as, like, the guys that when the postseason starts, they even hit another level. So when you, if you predict a Clippers-Nuggets Western Conference Finals, there's not a huge gap between a guy like Jokic and Kawhi in terms of what they can do in the postseason. And I think that's a different story if you put Jokic up against Anthony Edwards, even as much as I love him. You know, Jokic is going to win that battle of who's going to play better over the course of a 7-game series. Kawhi can actually put up a fight against Jokic and what he can do in a 7-game series.
Yeah, and then you go past that, and we go second best player. Paul George versus Jamal Murray. I think I'm going to take Paul George. That's a close one, and Jamal Murray's a playoff riser to the extent that not many people are. But then you go third best player, you know, Aaron Gordon or MPJ versus James Harden. I know who I'm taking.
Yeah.
You know, it's looking like the talent at the top is it very, very likely could carry the Clippers just straight to the Western Conference Finals.
Yeah. And you mentioned it earlier. Like, we mentioned some of their periphery guys, like their role players are good, too. This is not a top heavy team. This is an 8-deep team. They picked up Daniel Tice off the buyout market, and he has been legitimately good for them in a spot role, just catching alley-oops and stuff. Mason Plumlee, he's good for them, you know, and they're just waiting for Zubac to come back, who's having a career year himself. Terrence Mann defends great on the perimeter, is just an energy guy. Like, Norm Powell, like you said, explosive off the bench with his scoring. This is not like, okay, we have three players to bring us home a championship. No, this is a well-rounded team with a head coach who knows what the fuck he's doing in Ty Lue. They scream legit contender to me.
Yeah, man. And it's the biggest bummer in the world when NBA discourse revolves around, are they going to be healthy? Because that's literally the only thing that stands in the Clippers' way is Paul George and Kawhi Leonard being healthy at the same time. I think if either of those guys go down, it's going to be a little bit dangerous for the Clippers. I think Kawhi Leonard is a dude who could single-handedly win a series. Paul George, not so much.
No. We saw last year, like, Kawhi, through the first two games against the Suns, had people betting on the Clippers to win that series because he was just dominating. We don't see players play as well as Kawhi in the playoffs. We just don't see it. It's him and basically him alone. You know, if they go into the postseason healthy, it's going to be really hard to pick against them for me. And I'm going to just put this out on the podcast. I kind of believe in the health of this team. And I know that's like super taboo to say considering their injury history. But what else do they have to prove this year, right? Like, Kawhi's played 45 games. Paul George has played 46 games. James Harden, 44 games, and that's with him missing a few games after his trade. So it's like, I'm not sure what more they can do to prove to us that they're going to be healthy this year. We just have to take what they've given us so far. And up to this point, they've been very durable. I'll knock on wood just to, you know, keep the bad juju away from them. But I really believe in this team, and I'm very excited to watch them come April.
How great would it be if we could get a full season of Kawhi Leonard, like plus a playoffs? We've gotten how many of those in his career, man? Like three?
Yeah, like, basically. And two of them result in titles.
That's, right, yeah, dude. Just as, like, I'm getting way ahead of myself here, but thinking about, like, if they were able to make it to a finals, if they were able to win a chip, the sort of thing that that does for the legacy of Kawhi Leonard is hard to put into words, man. Yeah. I think James Harden ends up, you know, massively, massively appreciating that. But just thinking of where it would put Kawhi Leonard all time, it's hard to have that conversation.
I think Kawhi's legacy is one of the weirdest conversations we'll have to have at some point if we're just doing like a top 100 players of all time, because this is a guy who has less career points than Andrew Wiggins, but when he's on the court, you can make an argument there's not a single player better than him.
Right.
Both of those things are true at the same time, and it's just a really weird career he's had. And you're right, James Harden, with that, what he would benefit from a title is probably more than any other player in the league, who's a guy whose reputation is like a playoff team soiler and a big time moment pants pooper, contributing to a finals team would be ridiculous. So yeah, this is a really cool team, and I hope they can put it all together at some point.
Me too, dude. They had an excellent game last night against the Hawks, 149-144 in regulation. I mean, that is insanity. The fourth quarter was like 47-43. A lot of that was like in the last 2 minutes, people fouling over and over and over again. Yeah. But still, almost 150 points in regulation by the Clippers. That's insanity.
And let's talk about their counterpoint there, the Hawks, because they have a lot of news surrounding them right now as well. Obviously, DeJounte Murray's names have been in the trade rumors for weeks at this point. And the team he's been most connected to is the Los Angeles Lakers. And I kind of just want to go through like a thought experiment with you. D'Angelo Russell's been playing the best basketball of his entire life, the last like 13 to 15 games. Is DeJounte Murray a big enough upgrade for the Lakers for them to want to move on from that first round pick in 2029? What are your thoughts? Because D'Angelo is playing the best basketball of his career, and DeJounte Murray is a very good player, probably like a fringe all-star type guy.
Yeah.
So what are your thoughts on like DeJounte Murray as a basketball player, if he still has untapped potential to get better or go back to what he was in San Antonio as a defender, or his fit with the Lakers? Any of those questions you want to tackle, just let it rip.
I think if you're going to be the Lakers and you're going to do right by LeBron, doing right by LeBron means improving this team. You know, whether or not DeJounte Murray now is worth it, more worth it than a 2029 first round pick, it's such a toss up because we have no idea. Like, we know LeBron's not going to be on the team, but we have no idea what the Lakers will look like in 2029. Right. I do think, though, in terms of does it make the Lakers a better enough team right now to make it worth it? I think the answer to that might be yes. DeJounte Murray's not an excellent three-point shooter. He's at 37% on the year, which is higher than he might. That might be a career high for him.
Yeah, he's having a career year.
Yeah, so maybe if you're a believer that that's legit and that the amount of open threes he'll be able to get next to LeBron will help keep those percentages up, I think the defense he brings and just the heads-up play that he brings absolutely makes it worth it.
I think if he becomes what he was in San Antonio again as a defender, I think you need to bring this guy to the Lakers, because that's like an all defense caliber defender at the point guard spot who's also giving you 22-6-6. I think with that guy paired with Anthony Davis, that's a really, really good defensive team. And I think if that 3-point shooting's real, like you said, then that doesn't fix the Lakers' issues with spacing, but it definitely makes them better, right? Unfortunately, I just don't know if I believe it. I just don't know if I believe DeJounte Murray becoming like a plus defender again. I'm not sure that happens. And there's this weird thing with the Lakers where they get 3 first round picks to trade if they wait till the summer. They only can trade 1 right now at this deadline. So are you wasting a year of LeBron this year to like trade more picks in the summer to get maybe a better player than DeJounte Murray? Or are you trying to maximize every single year that belongs to LeBron because he's turning 40 next year?
I think we can guarantee, based on how the last couple of years of trading has gone for the Lakers, that if they have the opportunity to trade 3 first-round picks, they're not going to. So trading 1 now and getting a much better team probably, to me, is more worth it. I think what we're seeing with DeJounte Murray in Atlanta is a case of a guy who is maybe not given the role that he was promised when he was brought to the team, and he's very unhappy about being on the team. There was a thing that was leaked about him complaining to somebody in their Twitter DMs, like just a stranger on Twitter, about how if you watch the practices, he gets a lot more ball touches than he does in game. Like, that's kind of insane. And then when he was saying how much he would love to go back to the Spurs, this is clearly a guy who does not want to be on this team. And he's putting up great stats. Putting him in LA, bright lights of LA, I think he can handle it.
He's putting up great stats, and he's had multiple clutch moments throughout this year. He's having a career year as a three-point shooter. He's capable of playing off ball. He's shown us that he doesn't love to here in Atlanta. But I do think he's an interesting name that we have to kind of keep an eye on. And I think if the Lakers choose to forego trading for him this trade deadline, I think the guard on his team is an option they'd consider in the summertime with Trae Young. Trae Young, when they have 3 first round picks to trade and they can put Austin Reeves, and Rui Hachimura's contracts together to trade for Trae Young, is that a guy that's worth trading for to get to LA? And what does that make them? LeBron, Trae Young, and Anthony Davis. Is that a contending team in a West that's loaded right now?
Dude, the Trae Young conversation is interesting. I don't know if we had the conversation about him not making the All-Star game on the podcast.
We haven't.
But it's insanity that a guy averaging 27 and 11 pretty efficiently isn't in the All-Star game. He was second in fan voting. I mean, it's a testament to where the players and the coaches in this league rank him. It's insane. I don't know if it's just hate or if they see something that maybe other fans are not seeing. He's not the worst defender in the league this year. I'm not going to call him great, but he's trying his ass off. And there's a lot of guys you can look at in the league who are not. And so for a dude who's 6 foot on a good day, who's putting up 27 and 11, playing his ass off on defense, like, what more can you ask for from Trae Young? It's insanity that he's not an All-Star.
I agree. And I think putting him on a team that matters would be really interesting, because I think I've kind of come around to the fact that he's probably not a number one option, right? Like, he's just too small. Some of the things he's bad at as a number one option are kind of hard to fix around the periphery. But if you put him on a team with Anthony Davis, who he can just throw lobs to endlessly, or he can handle for LeBron and give LeBron a break as the lead ball handler. Like, I just think that's a super intriguing fit. And just in terms of how we talk about Trae Young in general as a player, you're right. Like, that dude's an all-star. This whole Derek White shit, like, yeah, he's good at basketball. That dude does not deserve to make the fucking all-star game over Trae Young. That's going to be stupid. The all-star reserves are already. Okay, yeah.
Yeah, he did.
Yeah. I'm glad he didn't. But the whole conversation around that was stupid to begin with. Like, one guy averages 15 points per game and his team doesn't fucking care if he's not there. And the other guy's team can't operate if he's not there because their offense goes down from like fifth to middle of the pack. So I'm a Trae Young fan. I'm not going to say I'm a Trae Young defender. Like, I'm not going to go to war for him, but I just think he's underappreciated right now in the NBA.
Yeah, I'm certainly not someone who goes to bat for Trae Young very often. Yeah. I think it's genuinely hilarious that we have another season that he is just doing shit that really point guards are not doing, and he's not making the All-Star game again. Yeah. Over the last 5 years, he is number one in total points plus assists, and he's only made the All-Star game in 2 of those 5 seasons.
Yeah.
It's unbelievable. So maybe that is a testament to like how other players feel around the league, how other coaches feel around the league in terms of, is this a guy that we could build around if he was on our team?
I guess something I'm still confused about when it comes to the conversation with Trae Young is this is a guy who's kind of a giant slayer in a weird way. Like, he went up against the Celtics last year, and after two horrible games, he turned it around and averaged 30 for four straight games and, like, pushed that series farther than it should have ever gotten.
Correct.
And honestly wore on the Celtics' legs a little bit, which led, I think, to part of their demise. Like, this is a guy that really can fucking change the course of a playoff series. It feels like we treat him like a playoff pants pooper, but I don't put – that's not how I view him in any regard.
You're absolutely right. We treat him like a guy that you cannot win with if you're going into the playoffs, and he's already gone farther than a lot of guys his age. I mean, right. He's made it to an Eastern Conference Finals.
Yeah.
The Hawks had no business winning one game against the Celtics, and they won two off of him being one of the best pick-and-roll players in the game.
Correct. Like, maybe ever. Seriously. Like, the way he runs the pick-and-roll and the way he manipulates passing angles to shit is fucking crazy.
When he is on, there are very few players who can do what he can do. He's Luka Doncic, but 6 feet tall when he's on. But then when he's off, he's just awful. And I think maybe players and coaches are kind of looking at those games, even though there haven't been that many this season. Maybe they're just haters, man. Maybe that's just what it is like Trae Young has pissed some people off and they just don't want to reward him.
Like, who would you rather take, Jaylen Brown or Trae Young?
I think this season Trae Young should be an all-star over Jaylen Brown, but I'd rather have Jaylen Brown.
Trae Young or Karl Anthony Towns?
Oof. That's a tough one. That is a tough one. Maybe Trae. Maybe Trae.
Okay, Trae Young or Ja Morant?
Ja.
Okay. So we're saying Trae Young's a top 22 player, basically.
Somewhere in there, yeah.
Yeah. That's a very freaking good player.
Yeah.
That's a very freaking good player. So I'm glad that me and you are on the right side of history with this one. I believe that Trae Young's a very good basketball player, and I'd like to see him in a new situation or just the Hawks kind of round out their talent and maybe get something good back for DeJounte that make them more competent.
Now, my question, I guess, is do you think Trae Young is a dude who could accept being a number two option on a team?
That's a great question, man. And it will really impact his career based on the answer of that question. Because if he says yes, then I think he could be a winner. If he says no, I think we're going to see him on middling teams for a while.
I think so, too. And it seems like the Hawks have kind of made their bed with the fact that Trae Young is their guy.
Yes.
And, you know, the trade deadline is in 2 days. We'll see if DeJounte Murray gets moved. There's lots of conversation around it, but it seems like the Hawks are pretty stuck with Trae Young for the future.
I have one more team that I heard is looking for DeJounte Murray that kind of surprised me, and I'd like to hear your reaction to it as well on the pod. The Utah Jazz are hunting for DeJounte Murray, and I was very intrigued by that because they have kind of struggled with point guard this year. Colin Sexton is kind of a combo guard. Keontae George is definitely more of a shooting guard than a point guard. If they traded for DeJounte Murray, they'd have a point guard under contract for the next 3 years, and a team that I think could actually, you know, threaten to win a play-in game with DeJounte Murray, Lauri Markkanen, and John Collins, Walker Kessler. Like, they would actually have kind of a formidable team. What are your what's your thinking on them pursuing DeJounte Murray?
That's a good question. I don't like it purely from the perspective of Keontae George's role would shrink. I don't think DeJounte Murray is a big enough difference maker that the Jazz would become anything other than like a team who's towards the top of the play-in. I want to see Keontae George blossom into an all-star. And maybe that is just biased thinking and you're asking the wrong guy. But, like, I have too high hopes for Keontae George to want to see him put into, like, a seventh man role with DeJounte Murray on the team.
We differ there. I'm not nearly as high on Keontae George as you are. So I'd actually like them to go get DeJounte Murray because I think it makes them kind of frisky and competitive. But they still have other teams' first-round picks to benefit from. They don't really need their own. So that's where I land on it. But I thought that was an interesting fit and an interesting team that would be a buyer at the deadline when I thought maybe they were doing a soft rebuild.
I honestly, it's weird because they have the assets to go in both directions. They already have a treasure chest. And yeah. They also have interesting players. They also have good young talent. So, like, realistically, if they thought DeJounte Murray was a difference maker, they could go get him pretty easily.
Yeah, like, right away. Yeah. So, that's a team to watch out for. Another quick trade thing that I want to talk about is Miles Bridges to the Suns. Now, we know, if you're a longtime listener of this podcast, you know that we hate Miles Bridges. He's a bum, he's a criminal, whatever, right? In terms of a basketball player, he's a very good basketball player. And the Phoenix Suns, who are devoid of assets, have been connected to him at this trade deadline because Charlotte has finally given up and have admitted they are sellers. And the Suns, who have very limited resources, have a chance to upgrade their team in a kind of a big way with bringing him to their team. If that trade does happen, Ben, do you view the Suns any differently? Does it make them legitimate contenders for you? What are your feelings about this team?
I think it would be a real wrinkle that would be added to Kevin Durant's legacy that in an effort to win, he brought a woman beater onto the team and it still didn't get the job done. I think that would be a narrative that we would kind of start to have with Kevin Durant in the future, that you brought Bradley Beal to the team, you've got Devin Booker on the team, Grayson Allen's having a career year, and you need to bring the biggest piece of shit in basketball onto your team for a chance to win. It's interesting because if you're just looking, like if this was a different name, if it wasn't Miles Bridges and we were just looking at what this player brings on paper, of course that addition to the Suns would be excellent. But like, you can't ignore who the actual person is that you're bringing into your organization. And like, if you bring him to the team, you're probably signing him long term, right? You're not keeping him just for a half year rental.
You're probably right. Yeah, you're probably right. Because his contract ends at the end of the year. And you're right. Like, you can't forget about the person, but I think they will. There have been examples in sports where players that have done disgusting things off the field come back to their team and people try to forget who they are. And it's a lot easier to forget who they are when they're winning rather when they're losing, right? We just saw with Deshaun Watson. Nobody forgot about what he did because, one, he's a garbage human being, but two, his team was shit, right? If he came out there and was a top five quarterback, you'd probably hear less whispering about how horrible of a human he is. Is that okay? No. That's just the reality of the situation, right? So if Miles Bridges gets moved to the Suns, I think that team becomes better and becomes pretty talented on paper. Like you said, if we're forgetting the human, right? If we're forgetting they're bringing the biggest piece of shit onto their squad, just from a talent perspective, I think it's a pretty huge upgrade. And I do anticipate them to fucking trade for that guy. I think they're trying to load their arsenal as much as they can, no matter what it takes or what damage it does to any of their reputations.
That is the thing, man. I mean, if you do that, you must win a championship. There is no making that move and then flaming out before you get to the Western Conference Finals because the Clippers are too hot for you to handle. Like that, Kevin Durant's legacy does not survive that. I don't think. What more damage can you do? He's already the dude who can only win in Golden State. But like that kind of cements it as like it doesn't matter how much talent you bring to the team. Like you just couldn't get it done. I don't know. I hate it, but I hate it just because of who it is.
Correct.
But
that's totally fair. And that's a reaction that a lot of people will have to hearing that trade news. It's just like, fuck, I want to root for my favorite team, but now I can't because they brought a scumbag onto it. Like, that is a reaction that will happen in Phoenix. Your reaction is completely justified. From a talent standpoint and from a legacy perspective, Kevin Durant is approaching this point where we kind of know who he is as a basketball player, right? Like, he's a no-doubt top 15 guy to ever play basketball and probably just the greatest scorer basketball has ever seen. A guy who doesn't monopolize the basketball, can shoot from anywhere, can finish in the paint, whatever. But I do think we're starting to get to this point where those two titles in Golden State, they meant less than a normal title when they happened. But looking at his post-career from Golden State, they kind of almost mean even less because he hasn't had the success by himself in his situations that he's picked with the players he's hand-chosen. We're getting to a weird point with him right now where it's like, dude, you gotta find a way to make this shit work.
not only has he not found a way to make it work, Golden State was able to win a title before he joined the team without him and after he left the team without him. So, yeah. You know, definitely those are the two least impressive championships of all time.
Easily.
This, I mean, if he wins the championship, we forget about the fact that Miles Bridges was on the team.
Yep.
That's really how it goes down in NBA discourse. You can outpace being a piece of shit by winning.
It's just the truth. That it's unfortunate, but it is the truth. Sports.
Absolutely.
Yep.
I don't think they can get it done. I don't think they beat the Clippers. I don't think they beat the Nuggets.
I agree. I think even from a talent standpoint, they match up with those two teams. But I think from a cohesion standpoint, a coaching standpoint, they don't sniff the Nuggets or Clippers still, even with a massive talent upgrade, in my estimation, bringing a 6'7", you know, uber athletic forward to your team that can switch between the wing positions and throw down crazy alley-oops and dunks and provide like a driving force to the basket. Even bringing that guy, I still don't think they could beat the Clippers or Nuggets. But I do think we should anticipate that move happening because I think there's been a lot of connections through social media and different reporters saying that the Suns are heavily pursuing him.
Yeah, I think rewarding Miles Bridges in his first season back by bringing him to a title-contending team, I think that's shameful. I think that's the sort of thing that you should get. Like, that should be a stain on your legacy forever.
I think it's partially that the Hornets are selling and the Phoenix Suns are buying. I don't think it's, you know, hey, buddy, we love you so much. Congratulations for making it back to the league. We want to see you in a good position. I think it's more of the Hornets don't want to pay that dude. And if they can get anything for him, they're going to be very happy. And the Suns are willing to forget his reputation just for talent's sake. I don't view it as a reward to Miles Bridges. Unfortunately, though, he is being moved to a much better situation.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a whack one, man. It's a whack one. We'll have to talk about it when it actually happens. The trade deadline is 2 days away. It really feels, I don't know, it feels like it's going to go mostly chalk. Miles Bridges to the Suns, that feels like a lock. I honestly don't think DeJounte Murray will be moved. The Sixers are no longer going to be making trade moves, and maybe we can just kind of pivot right into that with Joel Embiid. And the, I don't know, weirdness around what Philadelphia is doing with his injury. He tore his meniscus. Yeah. He had surgery on a torn meniscus. Guys who tear their meniscus do not come back in 4 weeks. I don't care that they're reevaluating him in 4 weeks. What they'll find out is that he has more weeks to go. Like, I don't understand what the Sixers are doing with all the weirdness surrounding his injury, but he is gone for the season.
Right. I'm sure you're referencing the Woj tweet. I'll just read it for our listeners here quickly. Philadelphia 76 star Joel Embiid underwent left meniscus procedure on Tuesday and will be reevaluated in approximately 4 weeks.
They avoid the word surgery in there.
Right. He then goes on to say, how Embiid's recovery goes over the next few weeks will be paramount, but there continues to be a belief that the door isn't closed on the possibility of reigning MVP's return to this season. So, from Woj's tweet, it seems like the Sixers are prepared to lose Joel Embiid from anywhere from 1 to 2 months, okay, at minimum. Let's say he comes back a week or two before the postseason. Approaching the trade deadline, we're 2 days away. They have a lot of expiring deals. They have picks to trade. Are you still going in on this season to bring assets in to try to keep your team's record afloat without Joel Embiid? Or are you just calling this a wash because you don't think you're getting Joel Embiid at 100% in the playoffs?
So I think Woj is lying. I think the Sixers are well aware that Joel Embiid is not going to come back anytime soon. And I think they're saving face to sell tickets. If there's a part of them that genuinely believes Joel Embiid's going to come back healthy when the playoffs start, they probably should be moving assets to improve the team.
Okay. That's an interesting perspective. That the 76ers are pulling a scam on all their fans.
I think that's what's happening.
So we have seen Joel Embiid go through a very similar injury just as soon as last year. This is the same injury he had last year, except it's on the opposite knee this time. Now, he went into the postseason. He looked horrible. And he got, I think, a little procedure done, like just to clean something up. And he came back against the Celtics And he was okay. I think he had one 30-point game, but the rest was shit. I believe that's how the series went. I don't remember every single thing. But from my perspective, if you can get 85 to 90% of Joel Embiid back, right? Because he does have a window to recover here. There's quite a bit of time left in the season. It's not even the All-Star break yet. If he can take two and a half months off just to make sure he feels healthy again, you should be bringing people onto your team to try to keep that record afloat, because they are starting to fall down the standings. The Cavs are starting to rise. The Knicks are starting to rise. They are now the fifth seed. And, you know, a few good weeks from Indiana and a few bad weeks from them, they could be the sixth seed and they could keep falling. I think they should be still actively trying to bring assets onto their team.
Yeah, I mean, they've lost six of their last seven games. It took a 50 bomb from Tyrese Maxey to barely beat the Jazz. So yeah, this is a team where if Joel Embiid comes back, they are a six seed when he comes back. So yeah, if you could do anything to stem that bleeding and try to just maintain a 500 record, that is what the Sixers should be doing. Now, if they don't believe that Joel Embiid's actually coming back and all of this is just posturing, they're not going to make a move. They're not going to do anything at all.
You're so right, and that is such a good tell that we should all be paying attention to come the 8th, is if Philly is involved in talks and are actually making deals, that is a very good sign for Philadelphia fans. If they are dead silence and no transactions have been made with Philly, expect Joel Embiid to not play the rest of the year. I think that's a very, very good observation you just made.
Yeah, man. It's heartbreaking. It's heartbreaking. We had the talk either last pod or the one before about how Joel Embiid was going to miss MVP talks. You know, he's probably going to end the season. Right now he's at, let's see, how many games played? 34 games played for Joel Embiid. If he ends the season over 40, I will be shocked.
Same.
So what this is just a half season of one of the craziest statistical performances of all time. 35 points, 11 boards, 6 assists with a steal and almost 2 blocks a game. So, you know, if this is all we get to see for this season for Joel Embiid, I'm so happy I got to tune in. Holy shit, what a fun season it was.
Yeah, and we spoke about Kawhi's legacy and Kevin Durant's legacy earlier in this episode. I think this is another guy that it is going to be such an interesting conversation when it comes to who was Joel Embiid. What was his impact on the league when he was around? And the answer will be, up to this point, a guy who fucking dominated the regular season, and that was it. And that is a weird career to have for what I perceive as an all-time great talent, where we really haven't seen anything like Joel Embiid, a 7'2" guy who hits fadeaways like Kobe, but can also dominate in the paint like Shaq. He's a very unique player. But this is a guy that's body, you know, from the jump was breaking down, right? He missed his first 2 years in the league with a broken foot bone and like a backbone. And then his brother passed away, leading to more missed time. And just like his story's been kind of tragic from the start in terms of just missing time. Unfortunately, that injury bug has stayed with him basically his entire career.
Basically, yeah, the story has been, you know, improvement after improvement after improvement in the regular season, and to Joel Embiid becoming one of the most insane centers to ever play the game, and then just not having the ability to stay healthy when it all matters. Whether or not he's a pants pooper or he's 7'2", 300 pounds and trying to carry the weight of an injured back and an injured foot and an injured everything. We don't know. We don't know. It's an unbelievable half season from him. I really think it's hopeless for Sixers without him. Tyrese Maxey's great as a scorer, but like the hopes that they could remain a top 4 seed without Joel Embiid, there's no chance. No chance.
I am totally with you there. There's no chance. With the way the Knicks and the Cavs are playing right now, like, those teams are cemented in the top 4, and Boston and Milwaukee are just too talented to slip a home court advantage. Like, that's never happening. So, yeah, the 76ers have lost their home court advantage for the year. Now it's just, can they continue being a relevant team without Joel Embiid? Like, I'm not so sure they can unless they make some deals at the trade deadline.
You're absolutely right. Right now, it does not look like they're going to remain competitive. And the couple of games that Joel Embiid missed before the injury, they definitely won a couple. They had a couple of really nice performances. You're just going to need a massive role increase from Tobias Harris. And yeah. I think we know he's a dude who can't handle that. His true shooting without Joel Embiid on the season is like 56% compared to like 62% when he is playing. So yeah. We know what these guys are. They're great complementary pieces. They're not anything else.
Right. And I don't know who the guy is that can save them either from the trade deadline and like who's available and who they've been involved in talks with. So this is going to be a very interesting rest of the season for the Philadelphia 76ers.
Very much so. I want to pivot and I want to talk about the Bucks in this new Doc Rivers era. He is 1-3 since coaching the team, and he's been rewarded with coach of the All-Star game. Went to the second seed this year. Should have been Adrian Griffin. I wonder if they're going to do anything. Probably not. It'll probably just be Doc and his staff. But what a weird thing, first of all, for Doc to be the coach, for the Bucks to be 1-3 so far. What do you feel about the Bucks so far?
So on our Big Pictures podcast, I brought up the question, can a team with bad losses actually win a championship? And the example I was using was the Milwaukee Bucks, because with Adrian Griffin as their head coach, they lost games that they should not have lost. And it just made me feel really bad about their championship odds to the point where I didn't view them as a contender. I kind of viewed Boston as the only contender from the East because they kept losing these weird-ass games. When they fired Adrian Griffin, I was open to, you know, letting Doc Rivers have the opportunity to kind of switch that up. And then they lose a game in Portland on Dame's return. And Dame, to just be completely honest, is kind of washed. Like, how he's the all-star starter in the East is just because it's conferences, right? Like, if we just look at, like, who are the best guards in the NBA this season, there's a lot of guys that are playing better than him right now. And his efficiency has dipped. I've seen so many tour date efficiency nights from him this year where it's like 5-for-23 and like 9-for-28 and shit. Like, that's just been happening at a much more frequent rate than I've ever seen. He's only shooting 42% from the floor and 34% from three. You can find those percentages anywhere you want to look in the NBA, right? Like, that is not a uniquely special player. I understand that he's still at a talent level to the point where you need to respect who he was. But what he's doing this year is subpar, and I think Giannis did not get the player he was expecting to join.
That's definitely true. I think that's definitely fair. The 35% from three is a little bit misleading, because it's on 8.5 attempts. If you believe it, he's at 25 points a game at 60% true shooting on the season. 60% is the mark of a good season. And I know context says otherwise, but that is, you know, it's not who he was last year. It's not 32 points a game on 64% true shooting. And it's not what we expect from Dame Lillard. But the stats are maybe better than people would think.
They're kind of not, and I want to explain this. The free throws are inflating that true shooting percentage by a fucking million. He's a very efficient free throw shooter, and he takes a lot of them a game. When it just comes down to basic half-court offense, can you fucking score a basket? His ability to score a basket has diminished in, like, half. That's what it feels like when I watch him. So the true shooting says, like, yes, this is still an efficient season. I don't care what the true shooting says. In half-court sets or in transition when he takes a transition pull-up three, I don't ever think it's going in. This is Damian Lillard I'm saying this about. So, like, analytics will say this is a good season. I think it's ass.
Analytics will say it's not as ass as people are framing it to be. 50% from two-point land, 35% from three, 92% from the line, 25 points a game. Statistics will say this is a bad season compared to, for Damian Lillard standards, maybe one of the worst he's had since he's emerged as one of the best point guards in the league. But, you know, I understand a little bit why he made the All-Star game. And the fact, I mean, you know, he deserved to make the All-Star game. I think Jalen Brunson probably should have been the starter. But I'm not out on Damian Lillard for the season. I'm not ready to say that he's washed. That game was terrible. The game that they just lost to Portland was terrible from him. Or to Utah, sorry. Was terrible from him. But I don't know, man. I'm not ready to count him out completely.
I think I am. I think I am for this year. I'd love for him to prove me wrong, because I was really excited about watching this pairing. I thought it was going to kind of be like a modern version of like Kobe Shaq, where you have a crazy dominant interior presence in Giannis and then a dominant perimeter presence in Damian Lillard. And I thought it was going to be similar to like Jokic Murray level, and it's not close. It's not close. Like, Jokic and Murray is still the best duo in the league. This doesn't sniff it, which is upsetting to me. Like, I thought they would at least be in a conversation. They're not. This is just a weird fucking team. And in terms of Doc Rivers, which was the origin of this conversation to begin with, I still think he's better than Adrian Griffin, right? I think the loss to Denver makes sense. And I was actually impressed by that game, because they didn't lose it defensively. They lost it offensively, right? Like, they actually kind of held Denver down, preventing them from scoring, you know, 125, 130, which we're used to seeing the Bucks doing. So that actually encouraged me. The loss of Portland, like, I have no fucking idea what happened there. And then Utah, they were missing two of their starters, but the Utah Jazz outscored them 40 to like 18 in the fourth quarter.
Yeah.
With Giannis and Damian Lillard playing. That's impossible. That's literally impossible. So the incompetence continues, which is like losing horrible games and blowing huge leads and all this shit. I don't care that the Utah game was on a back-to-back. I do not give a fuck. You had a 18-point lead in the fourth quarter and you lost to Colin Sexton and Walker Kessler. That's not okay.
You're correct. You're correct. If the season ended today, Giannis would be the first player in NBA history to score over 30 points a game on better than 60% field goal percentage. He is insane, and he continues to be, if you know, either the best or the second best player in basketball. We talk a lot about the blame that Giannis deserves for the way the team is constructed. How much blame do you give him for bringing Dame to the team? Do you think it was a good idea?
All of it. Do I think it was a good idea? I think moving on from Jrue Holiday was a great idea.
Yeah.
Because we've seen time and time again this dude poop his pants in the playoff as an offensive player. And now just recently, Jimmy Butler gave him 56 points in a closeout game. So, you know, this is the guy you have on your team to stop the perimeter players. And then he gets body bagged over and over and over again. I think it was time to move on from him. But getting Damian Lillard, in hindsight, you know, obviously hindsight's 20/20. You think you're getting the 33 point per game, 37% from three, 40, it's 47% from the floor guy, not this version of him. So I give him all the credit for bringing him in. It just hasn't worked out the way he wanted it to.
Yeah, you've brought a dude who is almost 34 onto your team, who is a short score first guard.
Yeah.
We know how that goes. We know how that story goes when you're a short score first guard and your explosiveness and your athleticism starts to drain. You know, we've seen it with some really, really good scorers in the past. I don't think we've seen the last of good basketball from Damian Lillard. The Clippers with James Harden took six or seven games to become a good team. We've given Doc Rivers four games. They've been four bad games, and I have no faith in Doc Rivers, but like, you know, we do have to give it some time. This is not the best version of the Bucks that we're seeing right now. Clearly, they are going to hit another level, but I'm worried. I think I kind of said this when we talked about Doc Rivers as a coach. I think they're at the level of the Cavs and the Knicks. I would not put them at the Celtics level, even though all the talent on their team says they should be.
I'm with you on that now. I'm with you on that. I think they are not a team that could just walk in and beat the Knicks. I don't think they're a team that could just walk in and beat the Cavs anymore. I really, really don't. Who the hell is guarding Jalen Brunson and Donovan Mitchell if those series happen, right? Like, we've seen what Donovan Mitchell can do in a postseason series. He will give you 35 points per night if you don't have a guy who's competent enough to stay in front of him.
Mm-hmm.
I think you're right. They're not on the Celtics tier or close to it. I do believe they're on the tier below for sure.
and there's nothing that can really change that. I mean, are we going to see, are they a team that could make moves at the deadline?
I think we've heard some rumors about Bobby Portis being moved. And what I think is interesting, and this is a similar situation Minnesota's in, is when your emotional leader is not producing the way they should be on the court and how you manage those two things, right? Do we keep the guy here because he means a lot to our locker room, or do we bring in a player that's a better fit for us on the floor but may not provide the emotional spark we need, and how teams kind of manage that question? I don't know. What are your thoughts? Do you think they move on from Bobby Portis? Or
I mean, the situation you just described, that's Marcus Smart and the Celtics. To a
check. Check.
Yep. And I, as a fan, when I watched that tribute for Marcus Smart, I wish he was still on the team, man. Like, just from a, this is my guy, I like watching him. But in terms of, does the team look better without him? Yeah. Yeah, of course it does. Of course it does. You know, you do give some shit up when you lose your emotional leader. Somebody has to get everybody motivated. Somebody has to pick up that scrap, but I don't know who it is, but it's worth making the trade.
I am so glad you just used that example, by the way, because I think it directly relates to the Milwaukee Bucks, where for years I was saying, okay, Marcus Smart is an emotional leader of a team that has no heart. So who fucking cares that he's the emotional leader? I was saying that for literal years on this podcast. It's the same thing with Bobby Portis now. This team has no heart. It has no fight. They give up. They cry. They moan. They bitch. They complain. Send Bobby Portis's ass out the door, because clearly his efforts in the locker room are not working the same way they used to. So bring in more talent that fits your team in a more conducive way to winning.
Is there a way Chris Middleton could be shipped? I don't think he's a dude you can afford to pay $30 million.
The thing is when he's on, he's so good. And the ramp up of his minutes has continued. I agree he got overpaid. That's also Giannis's doing. I think you have to hold on, because if he leaves, you're just not even close to competing with the Celtics. If Chris Middleton goes into a Celtics series on fire, you can make an argument that Milwaukee can still come out on top. But I understand what you're saying. It is an overpay.
Yeah, because I'm looking at just the salaries, and $45 million to Dame and Giannis, nothing you can do about that. You just paid Brooke Lopez $25 million on the year. You're probably not going to move him. So it's Bobby Portis at 11.7 or Chris Middleton at $29 million on the year. And maybe there just isn't a world where you could get legitimate pieces by shipping that guy out.
Yeah, I just don't see how Chris Middleton gets moved. Him and Giannis have been teammates their whole careers, their best friends. There is levels to it.
Yeah.
In terms of like what Milwaukee could get back for a guy like Bobby Portis, I'm not sure. The 11.7 is a pretty movable salary. Like, that's a pretty good range to be in terms of guys you could get.
Yeah.
You know, are the Bulls going to be willing to part with Alex Caruso for Bobby Portis in some seconds? I doubt it. I don't know, man. I don't know.
It's a situation where you really look at this team and like the amount of trash that they're paying. They're is that seventh highest paid player is Thanasis Antetokounmpo. like the amount of trash that's on this team. Campaign isn't playing much. Robin Lopez is getting $2 million. It's like outside of Bobby Portis and Pat Connaughton, there's no tradable contracts.
Right. Yeah, and I just did a deal on my phone in real time, so you just tell me if this is something that you can foresee happening. It would be Alex Caruso for Bobby Portis and two first-round picks from the Bucks. But those two first-round picks, New Orleans has the right to swap with, so the Bulls would be getting whatever one's worse each time.
Hmm.
But still, two first-round picks for Alex Caruso. I don't know. That feels like a deal that I would consider if I'm the Bulls.
The Bulls say they want an OG Anunoby-type package for Alex Caruso. I think that is insane. Delusional for thinking they'll get that. Bobby Portis and two shitty first-round picks. I think that's about as good as you'll get when you trade a guy like Caruso.
Yeah, I totally agree.
And you need that point-of-attack defender. That's really what's going to kill them when the playoffs start, is the lack of a point-of-attack defender.
The thing about Caruso at 6'5" is he's big enough to kind of swallow guards, and he's strong enough to defend wings still. Like, he'll have no problem guarding Jaylen Brown.
Yes.
No problem. right? That's a guy that the Bucks need on their roster, considering Dame is now their point guard. You can't have Malik Beasley out there and Damian Lillard. It's just going to be a problem that continues to bite them in the ass if they don't change.
You're right, man. Yeah, that is kind of the move, the golden savior move that could help them. I really don't see many others.
Yeah. Let's move on to something that we were kind of chatting about. Actually, no, let's do this first, and then we'll do to finish off the CBA talk. But who has the most to gain and the most to lose at the trade deadline? For me, I'll start first. This is a pretty weird one, but I think it's the Minnesota Timberwolves. I think this regular season record is a little fugazi. I think it's very Utah Jazz of 2017-2018 with Donovan Mitchell and Rudy Gobert, where all the statistics across the board look really impressive. Number one defense by a mile, all this shit. They are going to lose in the postseason if they don't get another adult in the building to handle the ball. I love Anthony Edwards. He is a mistake-prone player. Karl-Anthony Towns, mistake-prone player. Rudy Gobert, mistake-prone player. These are issues that are going to kill them in a postseason playoff series. And I think the match made in heaven for that team is Tyus Jones for Kyle Anderson and a few second round picks. Again, emotional leader who's not performing up to the standard he should be, traded for a guy that I think perfectly fits their team. And you have to sacrifice some draft capital as well. But I think Minnesota has a lot to gain from that. If they do that, I consider them real title contenders.
Kyle Anderson is taking 0.6 threes a game and shooting 19% from beyond the arc.
Yeah.
That's insane. It's gotten really bad. That's insane. Yeah, there is one mistake-free player on the Timberwolves. That's Mike Conley. He's 36, almost 37. So, yeah, Anthony Edwards needs to kind of take steps to become that guy, but right now they do need a guy who can be another mistake-free player. I do like Tyus Jones. I think that's a great move. Honestly, is this just a thing that follows Rudy Gobert everywhere that he goes? The fact that the whole number one defense, great regular season team, that it all means nothing?
It's a fair question to ask because, you know, as I continue to watch this team, I'm continued to be fucking terrified whenever he touches the ball, right? I just don't trust him to make a single smart decision come clutch time. And when there are other players on your team that you also have that question about with Karl-Anthony Towns, I trust Ant in clutch time moments to kind of put games away. Yeah. But when you have two players who make questionable decisions in the biggest moments of the game, you need to pick and choose when they touch the ball. And I think if you can rotate between Mike Conley and Tyus Jones, you can really limit mistakes as much as possible.
I think you're probably right, man. You know, every regular season, the thing that matters more than anything else is perimeter defense. Rudy Gobert deserved the three DPOYs that he has. Genuinely. He is a top five regular season defense. It's just when it comes to the playoffs, how much does that matter and how much does switchability matter? It really just flips as soon as the playoff starts. And a guy like Rudy Gobert instantly becomes almost a weakness to have to your team when in the regular season, he's one of the most important players out there. You know, we're getting to a point, the Timberwolves next year got to pick between Kat and Rudy Gobert, I think. Just in terms of the money that they got to spend, this is the year where it's like, we assembled the team for this purpose. We have to see it excel, and not going after another legitimate facilitator would be such a shame.
Yeah, but it's a thing that might not happen, right? If they view Kyle Anderson as the glue of their team and the glue of their locker room, and they just say, no, we feel like staying put, I think they take themselves out of contendership, which is really unfortunate for a team that I think, if making the right moves, could actually contend for a title.
Yeah, I think you're totally right. I want to pick three teams for you that are all around the same record. The Atlanta Hawks, the Chicago Bulls, and the Brooklyn Nets are all about the same record. And those are three teams who are on very different paths in terms of where their team building is going. The Chicago Bulls need to blow it up. They need to. You know, it's been years of this at this point, but Zach LaVine is shut down for the season. Caruso has to be moved. I honestly think a fire sale is what we need. Get as much value as you can for DeRozan. Get as much value as you can for Caruso. And stop waiting for Lonzo Ball to come back.
I agree. I doubt it happens, unfortunately. Like, have you heard any connections to DeMar DeRozan? Because I haven't. None. And he's having a very good year. 22 points per game. He's still playing 37 minutes a night at the age he's at. Like, that's pretty impressive. 5 assists, only 1.6 turnovers. This is a guy that could really change a team's chemistry and, like, ways they can attack the basket and score. I haven't heard a single team going after him, which I don't really understand.
Kobe White's emerged into a 20-point-per-game scorer.
And that's a contract you need to keep because they got a snag of a deal for him. I think they're only paying him, like, $14 million a year over the next 4 years, which is insane.
Unbelievable.
That's one of the best deals in the entire league.
12 million.
Oh my God. Like that's one of the best contracts in the entire league. So you hold on to that, but you get rid of DeRozan, you get rid of Caruso, you see if anyone gives a shit about Pat Williams anymore. And you just roll with Kobe White and bums for the rest of the year. And you try to get into a top five pick.
Yes. Yes. You do not need to be the 11 seed. You don't need to almost make the play in. We don't need to do that. Zach LaVine's the only guy being paid any amount of money on this team. DeMar DeRozan, it's the last year of his contract. He's not staying in Chicago. He's not re-signing with this team. So
crazy.
Yeah, they're running out of time to make moves. And I think just based on the history of this team, they're just going to run out of time. I think they're going to not take the deals for Alex Caruso. DeRozan's going to walk. Pat Williams, he's not worth much at all. So it's like, they should have made a move last year. Yeah. They made a mistake not doing it. Vooch is only paid $20 million a year. There's a team that could bite for that.
Yeah.
His offense is something.
Yeah. I don't know what Vooch is right now. I've liked to make the Bulls and the Warriors partners in these trades where Andrew Wiggins goes to the Bulls and, you know, they send back whoever, Vooch and Caruso, and then the Warriors add a salary to make that work and picks, because Chicago should be viewing themselves as a team that can accept horrible contracts and get assets for doing so. That's what they should be viewing themselves as right now, and I'm not sure they do.
And real quick, just like Zach LaVine, he decided to shut himself down for the season. He's getting paid $43 million next year, $46 million the year after that. The buyers for Zach LaVine, very quiet. Very, very quiet. Like, we're kind of at the point where if they want to move on from him, they're going to have to attach assets to get rid of him.
It's one of the worst contracts in the league, and it's not because Zach LaVine's a bad basketball player. He's just drastically overpaid, right? Going at the $40 to $45 million a year range for Zach LaVine doesn't make sense. The $25 to $30 million range, that's completely reasonable for a guy who's scoring 25 points per game and can light it up from three. That I'm fine with. But the $40 to $45 million range and has multiple years left on the deal, the Bulls are in a very sticky situation with that contract.
They're kind of in like nightmare scenario. They've waited too long to make moves. The guy who they're paying the most amount of money, they can't move now because he's hurt. Like,
right.
And nobody wants him. They're kind of in a nightmare scenario.
I think if you're Golden State, you should try to pursue Zach LaVine next season with sending Andrew Wiggins and, you know, freaking who else? Dario Saric, I guess. Just to make contracts work, send them to the Bulls. Or you can do a Chris Paul for Zach LaVine trade straight up right now and just get the Bulls off the contract. I think they might do that just to get the expiring deal in the summertime. I think if you're the Warriors, you get a talent play and, you know, it is what it is. You have to roll. You have to sacrifice for talent now if you're the Warriors to maximize the rest of Steph Curry's career. And if you're the Bulls, you might just be free from a contract that could end up very poorly.
I agree.
They are in a weird, weird spot.
Very weird spot. I got one more team that I really think needs to make moves at the deadline and really think about who they are. The Dallas Mavericks. Kyrie's only played 28 games. I understand that. The offense looks great when they play, but we're doing this again. This is another season of Luka Doncic and a bunch of okay players, and they're going nowhere. They're a touch above 500. Tim Hardaway Jr. either gives you 28 points or 4 points. Grant Williams does a whole lot of cardio. Like, all these guys just running around doing nothing, tricking people. They need to be on buyer watch, like, immediately. They need to be trying to improve this team.
Yeah, Grant Williams was one of the biggest things I was wrong on this season. Like, easily. I was banging the table for the Cavs to sign Grant Williams. They instead chose to sign Max Strus, which I was happy with as well. And I wanted them to go sign Grant Williams even after that and let Caris LeVert go. They said, no, we signed George Niang instead for cheaper. That has worked out perfectly.
You're right.
So credit to Kobe Altman. But the Mavs did what I wanted the Cavs to do and signed Grant Williams for $16 million a year. That is one of the worst contracts in the league. This guy, he's not doing anything. He started the season with the Mavericks shooting 51% from three. And it looked beautiful. When that shot's not falling, he's not doing much else on this team. He's not an above-average rebounder. The defense that – there's only so much you can do when you play with Luka and the Mavericks to cover up the defense. He and Derek Lively alone cannot make that a defensive team. So – this team's just Luka and a bunch of ass. And I also think Kyrie is one of the worst contracts in the league, and no one talks about that.
Yeah, I mean, they had to do that. They had to give Kyrie that contract to guarantee he stayed on the team and stayed happy. This is the bet that they've made, is Luka Doncic, you need to score 45 points, and you need to do it efficiently, or we don't have a chance. He scored 70 points and almost lost. To that one game, like, a couple of weeks ago, he only had 7 assists. He could have had 14 assists if his teammates just hit the wide-open shots he was kicking out to them. It's hard for me, because I understand where you come from when we talk about the unwatchableness of some of these Mavs minutes. And then I also watch Grant Williams miss wide-open kick-out three after wide-open kick-out three. And I can't blame Luka Doncic.
No, yeah. Grant Williams missing his 3-point shots that are wide open, I'm not gonna blame on Luka. I do, however, think the way this team is built is a direct correlation to how Luka plays basketball. None of these guys can do anything for themselves. Why did they sign them? Because Luka's doing everything for them, and that's the way Luka wants to play. So it's a kind of the chicken or the egg type situation with this team, where it's like, okay, Grant Williams, we need you to facilitate. Well, no, I've only been taking corner threes this entire year. You're asking me to make secondary playmaking decisions now? Like, I don't know how to do that.
We watched that in the Celtics, man. When he wanted the contract year, he was trying to do drive and kick shit. It was awful.
Yeah, right. So you can't sign guys and expect them to grow their games all of a sudden when their roles playing with Luka are actually reduced to a very specific set of skills. That's my issue with this team. And in terms of, like, things they can do, basically nothing. I mean, we mentioned Miles Bridges to the Suns earlier. That is a guy that the Dallas Mavericks have been connected to. I think that makes a huge difference for this team, because they're just devoid of talent. Like, they're not a good basketball team. This is a very interesting team. And it for me, it brings up the question, how long do you think Luka Doncic will be a Dallas Maverick? Like, is this a potential, like, see you later type deal in a few years because they just cannot figure it out around him?
It's so interesting, man, because it's so not really even the team's fault. Like, they're trying. They went and got Porzingis. It didn't work.
Yeah.
Porzingis, we want you to sit in the corner. Stop trying to create. We've got Luka. Just shut up and sit in the corner. Like, they brought Kyrie. The offense looks really fun when it's all together. So they're making attempts to try to win around Luka. What is the ideal team around him? Is it just the James Harden Rockets sort of thing, where you need to put a guy who can facilitate, and then you need basically all the players they have, but be better? Like, your job is just to shoot when we pass you the ball. We don't need any self-creation. Like, that right. seems to be the formula, and they're trying to do it, and it's not working.
And it's weird. You can do the whole Kristaps Jalen Brunson conversation tied to Luka as well, right? So, like, Kristaps, he's frustrated. He gets no post touches. He hates being a pick-and-pop player only. Forces a trade out, okay? That's not awesome. Why did that happen? Because Luka's dominating the ball. Jalen Brunson moves away from the Mavericks and within two seasons becomes an all-NBA caliber point guard. That's not who Jalen Brunson was on the Mavericks. Why? Because he had no opportunity because Luka was handling the ball. This is not shade on Luka. Luka is an all-time basketball player already. If he retired today, he would make the Hall of Fame. That is fucking crazy as like a sixth-year player, okay? But there is something to note when it comes to team building and championship basketball where Luka does not fit in that conversation for whatever reason.
You're right, man. I mean, this is Luka's sixth season, and he's been All-NBA first team four times in six years.
It makes no sense. It makes no sense how good he is at basketball.
He is a transcendent basketball player. Maybe we do need to get him off the team. Luka is not your number two option. If he goes to a team, it's his team. But maybe there's another team with better role players already set up, built around him. What is the team, though? Where is a team that, like, you just plop in Luka Doncic and everything works around him?
Right. You know, a team that comes to mind just immediately is the Brooklyn Nets. Yeah. Right? You just got defensive wings and a defensive center that he could throw oops to. Mm-hmm. That kind of checks out, but that's not a championship team in my estimation. I don't think so, unless Mikal Bridges took another step up.
Yeah. The defense thing with Luka. They ask him to score 40 points a night. And when you're asked to score 40 points a night and dish out 10 assists a night, there's not a lot of energy to put in on the defensive end. We've seen LeBron James, who's a Hall of Fame level defender, take games off in the regular season for his entire career because you need to kind of have your legs for the playoffs. But Luka Doncic is kind of at another level. He's kind of at the Houston Rockets, James Harden level of defense where it's like a genuine disinterest in trying to guard anybody.
Yeah, and I think your phrasing there is interesting, where you said they ask him to. No, he asks to score 40 points a night and dish out 12 assists. That's just how he likes playing basketball. I know it's hard for some people to wrap their head around. James Harden was the same way. Daryl Morey wasn't like, James, we need you to score 37 points this year. No, James Harden scored 37 points that year because he fucking loved taking basketball shots. It's fun to score 60 points in a basketball game. It's fun to have 25 assists in a basketball game. Luka scoring 73 the other night? You think, like...
They had no shot of winning without him hitting that 70-point mark.
Which is legitimately crazy. But it's... I also think he loves to be able to say... I scored 73. I get to go out and do that shit. It's not a coach demanded thing. Go take 45 shots tonight.
It is the way the team's built. It's the way the team's built because of Luka, but it is the way the team's built. That every single game, Luka Doncic needs to take 20-something shots a game, and he needs to be the leading scorer, or the Mavs don't have a chance.
Something that I'd like to ask you is just, like, who is the co-star for Luka? Because we've seen Kyrie, and when they do play together, the offense is fucking crazy. Like, it really is hard to stop. Very similar to LeBron Kyrie back in their championship run. Is that the type of player you want next to Luka? A guy who can take the ball out of his hands and create for himself and just do magic scoring the basketball? Or is it more of like a Anthony Davis type, where it's just a pick and roll partner throwing alley-oops and someone that can actually protect the back line?
I think that might be it. I think there is no hope, like, no matter how much talent you put around Luka Doncic, he's not going to be a great defender. You need to have probably three great defenders, good defenders at least, sharing the floor with Luka at any time. So somebody like Anthony Davis, who is truly transcendent, like, by himself, he can be a top 10 defense. That could save Luka Doncic from some of his apathy playing defense. Maybe that is the guy. I think the thing with Kyrie is just, like, we didn't need more points. That wasn't the issue with the Dallas Mavericks with Luka Doncic, is, like, more offense. No, we need guys who can guard because Luka can't.
It's an he's a very interesting player, and he for me is very polarizing. I know for a lot of people it's just no duh, he's amazing, he's great, he's going to win a championship and MVPs one day. For me, he's a little bit more complicated just because of the conversation we've had today. He's a pretty weird case.
You're right, man. And even like, you know, it's interesting. I love the Houston Rockets James Harden comparison because that's really the only guy you can compare to. And it took a while. I mean, James Harden in the Sixers was a really good second option. James Harden for the Clippers has been an excellent second or third option. But it took a decade to get us to that point. You know, if we get to the point where it's like Luka Doncic is that age and he has to kind of turn back his role a little bit and accept it, I don't want to see that. I want to see this whole thing lead to title contending basketball like right now.
Right, because it feels like he's close to his apex, even though he might not be, right? 27 is usually when players hit their prime, and he's younger than that. He's got a few years to go before he hits 27. So, you know, at 27, is he just going to be at a level where it's literally like he drags the Dallas Mavericks to a championship? I have no idea, but I'm just so interested in the team building aspect around a player with the skill set he has and how difficult it is to actually make it a winner.
Yeah, man. And it would be really interesting to just see it on a different team. Is it really that difficult, or are the Dallas Mavericks just like criminally, criminally failing this man?
If you replaced Luka with Jalen Brunson, right? Like you put Luka on the New York Knicks right now where he had Julius Randle, OG Anunoby, you know, Hartenstein, Mitchell Robinson coming back from injury. Like, is that a title team? Probably, right?
Probably.
Right. So it's like, but Jalen Brunson's so willing to give up the ball, is a great 3-point spot up shooter. Like, there are things that, you know, it's just really
Tom
weird.
Thibodeau wants his guys to play defense.
True. And to Jalen Brunson's credit, as a 6'1" guy, maybe, he still tries his ass off on defense.
Absolutely.
Like he's bumping chests with people. He's staying in front of people. He's poking balls loose, even though he's not a physically imposing guy. I have no idea how Luka finds a team that makes him in contendership. I really don't. I don't get it.
Do you think there's a chance that if just Luka Doncic had a great coach, if he didn't have Jason Kidd and Rick Carlisle, that maybe there'd be less complaining and somebody else would be able to do more?
No, because I respect Carlisle. If you watch what the Pacers have done this year with just their offensive philosophy and how good they've been doing that, I respect Carlisle. He's also a championship head coach.
I don't respect Jason Kidd as a coach.
Jay Kidd is tough because he is actually like literally world renowned for his development coaching, right? But like in terms of, okay, we need a guy to bring us to a championship, I don't know if he's that guy.
No, I mean, like, tell me realistically, if you swapped out Jason Kidd with Mike Budenholzer, the Dallas Mavericks are probably a really good regular season team.
Probably.
Who knows what it looks like in the playoffs, but they wouldn't be 27 and 23 right now.
But is Kyrie still missing half the games?
Is Mike Budenholzer is the kind of coach who in the regular season, I think, can kind of plan around that.
It's hard to miss a 25-point per game score.
You're right.
As much as Kyrie misses games. They are just Kyrie. They say, hey, it was their decision to give a very injury prone player $45 million a year.
You're right.
It was their decision. They walked into that. But yeah, Dallas is at an inflection point right now. They had a great offseason, though. Like they drafted Derek Lively Jr., that is a home run pick at 12. Mm-hmm. They just need to find a way to bring talent in. I do think, unfortunately, it might be Miles Bridges. It's either the Suns or the Mavs that get them.
I would bank on it being the Mavs, genuinely. I think if you look at Phoenix, they don't need another ISO shot creator type guy, even though Bridges can do more than that. Dallas Mavericks need a guy who can create for himself effectively. Yeah. I wouldn't be surprised, honestly.
Yeah, and with Kyrie down too, he could step up in a big way in a scoring capacity. You might be right. Mm-hmm. You might be right. But we have one more thing to talk about here, and then we'll get out of here. This doesn't have to be a super long conversation, but you brought it up to me before the podcast, and I just think it's like a super interesting topic to talk about. And that's the new CBA coming into effect after the next year's season. So 2026 season is when it starts. We're entering a time where players are getting paid exorbitant amounts of money. Obviously, we saw it with Jaylen Brown, who both of us think don't deserve that caliber of cash. We're going to see it with Tyrese Maxey this summer. They deferred his extension 1 year, and he's about to get a boatload after probably winning Most Improved Player. We're going to see it with Jalen Green, Evan Mobley, Şengün, Cade. That whole draft class is up for extensions as well. And with the new CBA, you're basically only allowed to have two max players, and if you have anything more than that, you cut your championship chances in half. Because you're restricted from trading first-round picks. You can't take on players that have a higher salary than the players you're shipping out. All this crazy shit that really restricts you to promote parity in the NBA. So what are your just opinions on like the contracts we're seeing nowadays and how that's going to affect team building moving into the future?
I'm really seriously struggling to understand how it all works out. This isn't the first time there has been a massive spike in cap and we see guys who are overpaid. We talked about it pre-pod. Timothy Mozgov, I think, got a $60 million deal for 4 years. Chandler Parsons, yeah, I think, got $80 million for 4 years. At the time, those deals were insanity. But now that's a Kobe White contract. Like, there, you know, that, like, Zach LaVine's making double that. So...
Right.
You look at the league and like, how do you compete with Jaylen Brown making $60 million? How do you compete with Karl Anthony Towns and Rudy Gobert making a combined $100 million? Like, where is the money to spend on other talent? If Tyrese Halliburton makes All-NBA this year, his Supermax contract increases by a total of $62 million. How? Like, how, if you're the Pacers, can you do that? Can you pay him that additional money and still have the money to go spend on other talent?
It's a very interesting question, and I definitely know it hits close to home for you. I'm just going to read off the Celtics' top four contracts right now. Jrue Holiday's making $37 million this year and next. Kristaps is making $36 million for the next three. Tatum's making 32 this year and for the next three. Jaylen Brown is making $32 million this year, but then 250 for the next five afterwards.
Read out the last deal of that contract, of the Jaylen Brown year, if you've got it in front of you.
Let me see.
I think it's $63 million.
So this year it's 28. And then it goes to 49, 53, 57, 61, $65 million for Jaylen Brown in 2028.
To me, there's a 0% chance that you can be a title contending team paying Jaylen Brown $65 million. He is not the only one that's going to get this deal, too. He's the first of so many.
Right. And as a function of paying Jaylen Brown that money, you then no longer can spend money on anyone else on your team when the new CBA hits, right? You won't be able to afford a Kristaps Porzingis or a Jrue Holiday or maybe even a Derek White at $18 million. Like, the cap is becoming very restricted on what you can pay max deals.
To me, that benefits a team like the Mavs a lot. A team that's got one guy who's the man and then a bunch of other people. That seems like where the CBA is kind of leading teams into.
Right. And for my team, this is also something that I'm curious about because Darius Garland gets paid $34 million. Donovan Mitchell gets paid $33 million. This upcoming summer, Evan Mobley is due for an extension. Now, we've seen these rookie extensions before. We saw Anthony Edwards and LaMelo Ball and Tyrese Maxey all get five for $250 million, right? All three of those guys are getting paid $50 million starting next year. Are you going to pay Evan Mobley $50 to $60 million a year to stay on your team when you know that you can't afford to bring other players onto your team and just the two guys you're rolling with for the next 5 years is Darius Garland and Evan Mobley?
Right. So what does this lead to? Does this lead to a lot of teams just losing out on their homegrown stars and they just go to bigger markets?
Or does it lead to teams signing their homegrown talent, but letting a guy like Donovan Mitchell or Jared Allen go? Or letting a guy like Drew Holiday and Kristaps Porzingis not even join their team because they don't want the contracts? Right. I think it's going to lend itself to signing their homegrown talent. But I also think we're going to see some mistakes with massive contracts given to guys who don't deserve it. As much as I love Evan Mobley, $50 million a year for that dude, that is not correct. Absolutely. Right? Like, I'm a big fan, but 50 mil is crazy. So that is going to be something that we're going to have to watch out for when it comes to the new CBA. And I think one of the cool things the CBA will contribute to is a lot of parity. I think one bad contract that's 4 years long for a team at the top could send them to the bottom. And I think one great contract for a team at the bottom could send them to the top. And I think that gives a lot of teams heading into the season more hope that they can actually compete for something.
That's definitely true. That is definitely true. It's going to be a breakup of a lot of really, really incredibly talented teams. And all of those guys are going to be spread out amongst the league. So, right. You know, you're thinking about it. There's no question between $35 million for Donovan Mitchell or $36 million for Darius Garland. There's no question who you should pick, right? There's no question which guy should be on the team and which guy has to go. But Donovan Mitchell's leaving. It's going to bother me when it happens. And then 2 years later, nobody's going to care, me included.
Right. Right. Exactly. We'll just get used to it. We did with the KD free agency, right, where the cap spiked a crazy amount, right. And then people were just like, what the fuck? We got used to it. We understood after those first 2 years how it works and how you can create a team. It's going to be the same thing. But, like, just for thought, right, let's say Scoot doesn't really figure it out until halfway through his third year, similar to an Evan Mobley career, right, so far up to this point, where he's a little bit promising, right? He's showing flashes, but there's not enough consistency to love. If you go to Scoot in his extension and say, hey, buddy, we can't give you the $60 million a year, but we can give you $35 million a year. And he accepts the deal and then becomes an MVP level player on a deal that's half of what they could be paying him. Then you'd see the Portland Trailblazers shoot up the standings. I just think there's going to be, like, very interesting side effects of this new CBA where, like, if you get a great player on a good deal, like Lauri Markkanen right now only getting paid $16 million a year for all NBA caliber performances, Like, you're just going to be in a very unique position to win a championship.
It's going to lead to kind of one of my favorite offseason things ever, the poison pill contract. Like, Indiana giving DeAndre Ayton a max contract to make Phoenix match it. That sort of shit. I love that petty shit more than anything. And like, that seems like where we're going. It's like, all right, Either I'm paying this guy $50 million or you're ruining your team's future.
Right. Right. There's going to be chess played in the NBA for sure. Obviously, we're 2 years away. And I think with expansion as well coming soon to Vegas and Seattle, I think this also helps them. Not because usually when expansion teams come in, they're kind of ass for a long time. Right. The NBA tries to help with that by like the draft lottery. They get the first overall pick and they do the expansion draft where they can pick players off of other teams. But now you can just say, all right, we want to pay your guy $60 million and you don't want to pay your guy $60 million. Come over to the Seattle Supersonics. You know what I mean? Yeah, I just wanted to touch on that before we go, because I think we're heading into a really new wave, and Tyrese Maxey's upcoming contract extension definitely sparked that.
Yeah, we're heading in a crazy direction. It's tough, because right now, there's not many players more overpaid than Jaylen Brown. I love Jaylen Brown. I think he's a great fit for the team. I think he's an all-star, but he is not anywhere near a $60 million man. And he never will be. There's no path for him to become like first team all NBA. Like that's kind of the kind of quality of guy you have to be to deserve $60 million. There's no world where JB becomes that guy.
No, there's literally no world. And in the new format, when there's no positions on the All-NBA roster, is that dude ever making All-NBA again? No, he's not. He's just not. He's just not. So you're paying a guy who's not an All-NBA caliber player $60 million.
It's terrible.
It's terrible. It's terrifying for Celtics fans if they choose to, you know, keep him in the future into 2026.
Yes. There's going to be a world where there's like an extra 50 something million, even more maybe added to the cap. So like the fact that you're paying Jaylen Brown $60 million, you'll be able to find money from somewhere. But like, just thinking about the disparity, the fact that the league minimum is going to be like a $2 million still, and there's going to be Jaylen Brown at 60. Like there's going to be very few guys that genuinely deserve that mark.
Right. If you go through the like list, it's who? Jokic, Giannis, Luka, Tatum?
I mean, I don't want to give Tatum $60 million. Probably he deserves it, maybe, but like...
Shea, like these type of guys where they're like, no doubt, first team, All-NBA, no question. Those guys deserve it.
Back in the day, Michael Jordan got paid $30 million and there were entire teams getting paid $30 million. That's the sort of shit where it's like, only a few people in basketball deserve to make that kind of money.
Right. So we definitely have some interesting conversations coming along. We definitely need to do some sort of post-trade deadline podcast for you guys. I don't know when that will be coming, but I'm sure there's going to be a lot of moves. Ben, do you have anything else to say before we wrap up here?
That's going to do it for me. Thanks, everybody, for tuning in. We'll catch you later. Peace out.
Peace.